Rating the accuracy of drone strikes and underreporting civilian deaths. Daniel's house was searched in 2014. Like Julian Assange, he lived under a sword of Damocles for a better part of his adult life. In May 2019, he was finally arrested and indicted on allegations that he disclosed classified documents to the U.S. military's clandestine drone program, believed to have been the source material for a series in The Intercept called The Drone Papers. Daniel pleaded guilty to a single count under the Espionage Act and was sentenced to 45 months in prison. I think his case is a prescient warning of how an Espionage Act case against Assange would proceed. Bear with me. At sentencing, the judge recommended, he recognized that Daniel was a whistleblower and recommended that he be placed in a minimum security medical prison. But the Bureau of Prisons instead sent him to an Orwellian Communications Management Unit, nicknamed Gitmo North. There are only two such facilities in this country. Created in the aftermath of 9/11, they were intended to house terrorists. Daniel is a pacifist with no priors. Until recently, he has been housed in this special prison with the merchant of death, Victor Boot, who was recently released. So when the U.S. gives assurances that Assange won't be put in a supermax, don't be fooled, because he'll end up in a far worse place, one of these communications management units. In the CMU, Daniel is far more isolated from his support network, unable to receive the medical and psychological care he so desperately needs, and has more restrictions on his communications, reading materials, and visitors with other people than anyone on death row.
There are a few people in Washington, D.C. who were not afraid to talk about Julian Assange all these years, and our next member of tribunal is one of them. So it's my big pleasure to present the one and only Chip Gibbons, policy director of the organization Defending Rights and Dissent.
I want to start by acknowledging three people who cannot be here today. One is Julian Assange, who is imprisoned in a dungeon called Belmarsh. The second is Daniel Hale, who is currently being held in a communications management unit. I've been told that Daniel watches Democracy Now!, which is streaming this. Daniel, if you can hear this, I want to say on behalf of everyone in this room, you have our solidarity. Never let them break your spirit. A better world is possible only because of people like you. And the third person who can't be here is, of course, Edward Snowden, who exposed that our government was lying to us about how they were spying on us, and for this patriotic act was driven into exile while the lying spies continue to enjoy lucrative careers with war profiteers and cable news programs. And you have to ask yourself, do they view those as two different jobs? Because after all, someone has to sell the wars that line their pockets. The U.S. government knows, like we know, that without sources, there is no journalism. But the U.S. government is no longer content with merely going after the sources. They have made Assange the first person ever indicted under the Espionage Act for the crime of publishing truthful information. Make no mistake, the attempts to silence Assange is part of a larger war to silence those who expose the crimes of empire, militarism, and the U.S. national security state. And it's not just a legal war involving a prosecution, but an extra legal war involving covert action and propaganda. While the U.S. security state is cloaked in secrecy, there have been a steady trickle of revelations about the three-letter agency's war on WikiLeaks. The NSA added Assange to their manhunting database. The CIA plotted to kidnap and maybe even kill Assange. Various agencies sought to get around rules protecting press freedom by arguing WikiLeaks were not journalists. The NSA discussed the idea of declaring WikiLeaks a malicious foreign actor. The FBI and the CIA demanded a personal audience with Barack Obama to persuade him that rules protecting press freedom should not apply to WikiLeaks, as WikiLeaks should instead be classified as information brokers. I'm not sure what an information broker is. I don't think the CIA and the FBI know either. And finally, they invented the term hostile non-state intelligence agency to allow the CIA to engage in offensive counterintelligence against WikiLeaks, something previously reserved only for rival spy agencies and requires even less oversight, and there's very little oversight over the CIA, over CIA covert action. The U.S. government's legal and extra-legal war on WikiLeaks is a war on journalism itself.
Chip Gibbons, policy director of Defending Rights and Dissent, testifying at the Belmarsh Tribunal in the case of Julian Assange in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club. Coming up, Noam Chomsky, Dan Ellsberg, and more. Window Sad and Lonely by Woody Guthrie, sung by Billy Bragg and Wilco. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return now to the Belmarsh Tribunal in Washington, D.C., on the case of Julian Assange, it was held in January at the National Press Club. I co-chaired the proceedings with the Croatian philosopher and activist Srećko Horvat. And now to Betty Metzger. As a reporter for The Washington Post in 1971, she was one of the only journalists willing to cover leaked documents exposing FBI crimes, including surveillance of students, of academics, of anti-war and civil rights activists. One of the stolen files revealed the existence of one of the FBI's illegal programs, COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, under J. Edgar Hoover. She's the former chair of the Department of Journalism at San Francisco State University and the author of The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Betty Metzger.
I'm honored and humbled to be part of this panel that seeks justice for Julian Assange, sorely needed. I'm here with a case study, something that I think shows very clearly the great importance of protecting whistleblowers and the necessity of a free press. And it is the story of the people, the impact of the people who burglarized an FBI office in 1971 and then stole every file in the office and made them public. I've worked with them twice when I didn't know them and they sent files to me back in 1971, and then when I worked on the book when they revealed their identity, even though the FBI had at that time the largest search that they had ever had and didn't find the burglars. They came out in 2014. These eight people were outside whistleblowers. They were average citizens, though they did extraordinary things. In fact, they called themselves a Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI. They had decided that because Congress and the executive branch had never carried out responsibility to oversee the FBI, they would exact oversight as citizens in order to get documentary evidence of whether the government was suppressing dissent. And they made the decision to do this after thinking very seriously about it. Three of them had very young children, and they realized that if arrested and convicted, they could serve many years in prison. But they thought it was so important to uncover what this hidden, all-powerful agency was doing that they decided to break into an office. They used tools quite different from what the tools of today's whistleblowers. Instead of multiple thumb drives or vast spaces on the internet, their tools were a crowbar, a car jack, large suitcases, flashlights, and getaway cars, and eventually copiers. But their motivation was the same as the motivation of other whistleblowers: get important information to the public about injustices being done secretly by the government. They found what they were looking for: evidence of massive suppression of dissent. But they also found, and I should say, it's important that this was 52 years ago, and nobody prior to that was writing about anything about intelligence agencies. It was assumed both by the government, by Congress, the people who should have had oversight, and by journalists, that they had an obligation to let those agencies keep their secrets. There was no accountability. In the files that these people released, was a shocking policy: enhance the paranoia, get the point across, there's an agent behind every mailbox. They also found campus employees were hired as FBI informers and to inform on students and faculty. And every black student on at least one campus in the Philadelphia area was under FBI surveillance. They also found that Hoover operated a massive Stasi-like program throughout the country against black Americans. Every agent in the country was forced to participate and had to hire an informer to create files on black people. To be black in Hoover's mind was to be dangerous and therefore subject to surveillance by the FBI. They also discovered that Hoover maintained a security index, an ever-expanding list of people believed by Hoover to be subversive and who were to be secretly detained by the FBI during a national emergency. Calls for congressional investigation of Hoover and FBI died less than 2 months after the burglary. Congress had no appetite for this. But thanks to NBC reporter Carl Stern, a congressional investigation later became imperative. Without Carl's determined effort to find out what COINTELPRO was, those bureau operations, regarded eventually as the worst, might never have been revealed. Carl would like to have been here with us today, and I wish he could have been, but he has a very serious case of COVID. As a result of his successful lawsuit in December 1973, journalists were now armed with the stated purpose of COINTELPRO: to secretly expose, disrupt, and neutralize political movements. And they began requesting COINTELPRO files, and they started pouring out. The public now learned for the first time that the FBI conducted lawless operations that ranged from crude to cruel to life-threatening and murder. Prostitutes known to have venereal disease were hired to infect campus activists. FBI informers were coached to give false testimony against innocent people, people known to be innocent to the person testifying, testimony that led to convictions and decades in prison for the falsely accused, most of them black people. A plot was designed to cause Martin Luther King to commit suicide and murder. An FBI informer provided the Chicago police with the crucial information that made it possible for police to shoot Fred Hampton dead as he slept. In January 1975, thanks to all this information that came out, both the House and the Senate opened investigations of FBI and all intelligence agencies. It was the first time Congress had done such a thing. At hearings, high FBI officials testified under oath that Bureau officials had never considered the legality or ethics of COINTELPRO or any other operations. These hearings and the reforms the senators successfully recommended would not have happened without whistleblowers who risked their freedom and a free press that reported their important revelations, and ultimately a Congress that finally was willing to act, including establishing permanent intelligence oversight committees and strengthening the Freedom of Information Act. All of these reforms, as probably everybody in the room knows, have been battered and bruised at various times since then, but they exist and they are still valuable. It was Joe Biden's Congress that put in place the reforms that flowed from the media burglary. The Biden administration surely knows from the very important revelations made by whistleblowers in the past that this source of crucial information must not only not be threatened, but must be protected. To continue the prosecution of Mr. Assange under the Espionage Act of 1917 could not only continue Mr. Assange's imprisonment for decades, it also could, in violation of the Constitution, gut the First Amendment rights of journalists. A radical result that surely neither President Biden nor Attorney General Garland wants to have as their legacy. Thank you.
So the next speaker at this tribunal, and we have three more left, thanks a lot for the patience of all of you, is one of the most famous whistleblowers, not in U.S. history, but in global history, and it's my great honor to present him today, Daniel Ellsberg.
One of the foundation stones of our former government here in the United States, a democracy and a republic, is our First Amendment to the Constitution, which forbids any law by Congress or the states abridging freedom of speech or of the press, along with freedom of religion and of assembly. That press precluded the passage of a British-type Official Secrets Act, which most countries have. Almost no other country has a law singling out the press as protected by our freedom by the First Amendment. And the British type Official Secrets Act, which criminalizes any or all disclosure of information protected by the government, by the executive branch, even disclosure to the public or to the press or to the Congress, the Parliament, is criminalized and subject to prison. We've never had such an act because of our First Amendment. In fact, one was almost inadvertently passed by Congress in the year 2000, but it was vetoed by President Clinton as a clear-cut violation of the First Amendment. He cited in his opinion accompanying that some of the opinions in the Pentagon Papers case of half a century ago. That had resulted from my disclosure of information that I had authorized possession of as a contractor to the government at that time, 7,000 pages of top secret documents about the history of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, which disclosed a repeated sequence by four different presidents of lies and, in effect, violations of the Constitution, treaties, and in particular, misleading Congress as to the costs for war. I was facing 115 years in prison, but not for an Official Secrets Act, which we don't have. It was an experiment by President Nixon to use our Espionage Act, which had always been directed and intended for use against spies giving information secretly to a foreign government, especially in time of war. It had never been used, as it was by Nixon in my case, as a substitute for an Official Secrets Act for disclosure to the public. Up until Julian Assange's indictment, the act, however, had never been used as an Official Secrets Act is against other than sources like myself who had possession of information, who disclosed it to the public. It had never been used against a journalist like Julian Assange, although in each case, of course, of such disclosures or leaks, some form of medium was involved, many, many people involved in that, but they had never been indicted for that before. Actually, if you're going to use the act against the journalist in blatant violation of the First Amendment's denial of Congress's ability to criminalize acts by journalists, by the press, the First Amendment is essentially gone. As I say, we're almost the first to have it. We fought a war of independence and established a constitution, so we have First Amendment. Britain does not, where Julian now is, and they have an Official Secrets Act, which we don't. If we acquire that, we give up the main result, I would say, of that war of independence in the sense that we are no longer really a republic or a Democrat. We have monarchical powers, imperial powers, formally, and every empire requires secrecy to cloak its acts of violence that maintain an empire. The American, it's a major form in our change in our form of government.
Thank you, Dan Ellsberg. Before we turn to Noam Chomsky, attorney Suchitra Vijayan is formerly worked for the United Nations War Crimes Tribunals in Yugoslavia and Rwanda. She is founder now of the Polis Project, a New York-based research and journalism organization supporting civil resistance around the world.
The persecution of Julian Assange is not just about First Amendment. It's not just about the freedom of press. It goes to the heart of the crisis of citizenship, the rapid erosion of civil liberties in the hand of deeply authoritarian democracies in the West. We need to name the beast. We have to start calling Western liberal democracies what they are. They are deeply authoritarian, totalitarian, with deep lines of fascist ideologies that get implemented not today, but for over many, many years. Criminalizing dissent, persecuting dissidents, political trials, imprisoning journalists in high-security prisons and treating them as terrorists are not new. These are part of the long-established strategies of state terror. Throughout history, the U.S. government has incarcerated its political opponents, black activists, students, labor organizations, writers, intellectuals, anti-war activists, protesters, the list is long. Today, the U.S. considers its most dangerous enemies those who challenge its abuse of power and expose its crimes both at home and abroad. Assange is a political prisoner. He's a dissident of the West. His crime, exposing brutal acts of violence, abuse of power, and about the crimes against innocent civilians. For this, every legality, deception, and malice has been deployed against him. Systematic violations of due process, judicial bias, manipulated and manufactured evidence, constant surveillance, defamation, lies, propaganda, denial of basic dignity, assassination attempts, and threats. Just let that sink in. But why is Assange a threat? I came of age in the age of after the aftermath of 9/11. In the past 20 years, we witnessed a proliferation of militarized borders, camps, and carceral citizenships. As a young lawyer, I worked providing legal aid for Iraqi refugees in Cairo. During this time, we served over 800 families. Hundreds of legal summaries that I wrote were not just about asylum petitions or resettlement requests. These were also biographies of a destruction of a nation and its people. Imperial violence unleashed on them. Torture, death, mutilation, rapes, disappearances. In 2010, WikiLeaks posted classified U.S. military videos depicting the killing of dozens of unarmed Iraqis, including two Reuters journalists. The release confirmed what many of us had already known. The war in Afghanistan was no different. Orwell wrote, "The frightening thing about totalitarianism is not that it commits atrocities, but that it attacks the concept of objective truth. It claims to control the past as well as the future."
Last but not least, we have a very short message by one of the most important living public intellectuals of the United States, Noam Chomsky.
Our message for today is quite simple: free Julian Assange. Assange has been indicted under the Espionage Act. That's another shameful chapter in its sordid history from its origins. Should be stricken from the books. The act has no place in a free and democratic society. We should perhaps not be surprised that the act is now being used to punish the exercise of journalism, letting citizens know what is being done in their name. It's an unforgivable assault against the majesty of the state. The crime of the indictment under this disgraceful legislation is compounded by the years of imprisonment and torture that Julian Assange has already suffered. The targets of the indictment, however, reach far beyond their immediate victim. They reach, in fact, to all of us who hope to understand what is happening in the world, and to the journalism profession, whose task it is to perform this essential service in a democratic order. Those who seek to perform this honorable task are under harsh attack in these troubled days. That's more reason to assure the attack on journalism will not be joined by the most powerful state in human history. In short, free Julian Assange without further unconscionable delay.
Professor Noam Chomsky, speaking before the Belmarsh Tribunal on the case of Julian Assange, which took place in January at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. To watch the full 2.5-hour tribunal, go to democracynow.org. You can also watch our recent interview with Dan Ellsberg, who was recently diagnosed with inoperable pancreatic cancer. Special thanks to Chirina Nadura, Dennis Moynihan, Ishmael Darrow, Mike Burke, Robbie Caron, Sam Alkoff, Dina Guzder, and Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.